I next met with Dr. Bert O'Neill to mainly chat about hepatocellular cancer. And to begin, Dr. O'Neill presented a patient from his practice.
The first case here is a 68-year-old with what I see a lot of, hepatitis C virus-related liver disease, who had a transplant done 8 years ago. Interestingly, he had a chemoembolization prior to transplant to try to maintain his status on the transplant list, and then did very well. But in between two surveillance imaging studies that were just 6 months apart, he went from having a normal scan to having a very large recurrent lesion that, given the distance out from his transplant, was actually biopsy confirmed to be an HCC.
Were you involved with his care when he got the transplant?
I took care of him when he got chemoembolized and then up to when he got transplanted, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that decision and what kinds of patients are thought to be appropriate for a transplant, for example, as opposed to resection?
Absolutely. So, you know, for patients with cirrhosis, especially more severe cirrhosis, resection per se is not an issue. And so he fell into that category where his liver was sick enough that even though his tumor was not very large, it was not going to be resectable. And so he falls into the category of either, you know, one lesion less than 5 centimeters or three or less lesions less than 3 centimeters that are within the UNOS criteria for transplant listing. And for those patients who fall into those criterion, there's about an 80% long-term survival after transplant. So it's quite an effective therapy. And if you take the same kind of patient who can be resected, you're probably looking at more like a 40 to 50% long-term survival because of either worsening of liver disease or development of new tumors somewhere else in the liver.
Any hints about what actually happens when you develop recurrent disease after transplant or the residual cells or what's going on?
Well, I think that most of these recurrences do happen within the allograft. So the suggestion is that many patients do have residual circulating tumor cells that perhaps choose not to grow anywhere else, but they grow in that new organ. It's a very interesting sort of example of that seed and soil hypothesis.
Right. And you mentioned also that he needed a bridge, chemoembolization?
Correct, yeah.
And what actually happened there that prompted the decision to do that?
You know, we'll often, if patients have a borderline size tumor, so somewhere between, you know, 3.5 and just under 5 centimeters, we will try to do something to bridge them. And the thing we like to do best at our institution is embolization. The other option for some of them is ablation. There's some concerns about tract seeding when you do ablation. So chemoembolization, you know, you have a pretty good response rate. You allow the patient to stay on the transplant list without progressing. And, you know, I think it's just a good way to manage that particular group.
And in his case, how much tumor reduction did you see?
He didn't have much of a size reduction, but he had very nice necrosis after embolization. So often that's our best indication of a good response.
How did he tolerate that procedure, and how do people tolerate it in general in your practice?
It really depends on size of tumor and amount of liver we have to embolize. Our radiologists have gotten very good about subselectively embolizing smaller lesions. So patients who have small lesions embolized often do quite well. When we have to embolize more of the liver, people will get the classic post-embolization syndrome. So they'll get pain, nausea, fevers, and, you know, often just asthenia, anorexia that can persist for a few weeks. So some patients, they'll come back and tell me, I hope I don't have to do this again.
Yeah, and I guess also now getting into what happened when you developed recurrent disease after transplant, that must have been a pretty discouraging moment.
It was. I mean, I guess the good thing was he's in his 70s and he got, you know, 7-8 completely disease-free years. The shocking thing about this case was just how rapidly this thing developed. You know, I tend to think if you haven't seen something in 7 or 8 years, that suggests that whatever it is should be slow moving. But, you know, this thing went from nothing to about an 8-centimeter lesion in a 6-month period. It was quite shocking, actually.
So at that point, did he have symptoms from the disease?
He was modestly symptomatic. I would say he had some discomfort, a little bit of fatigue, but this was really a radiologic pickup. He wasn't dramatically symptomatic.
So what options did you consider at that point?
Well, this particular recurrence was large, but did not involve portal veins. He had responded well to embolization in the past. So that really was our principal consideration. Interestingly, we put him on a study that we were doing that added sorafenib. And that study, we were giving sorafenib for 2 weeks prior to embolization, followed with embolization. And he actually tolerated the sorafenib fairly well, then the embolization.
I guess no way to know whether or not the sorafenib added in this situation, or do you have any data from that study?
That study is still accruing and has relatively small numbers. I think that the real answer about that question will come from a study, ECOG 1208, which is a national study that unfortunately is sort of limping along in its accrual, but I think is, you know, really important. Our study was more of a pilot study to collect safety data on how patients tolerate sorafenib prior to embolization. You know, we were doing things a little bit differently than other studies had in terms of when we restarted the sorafenib.
What's the design of the ECOG study?
In the ECOG study, patients are getting pre-TACE sorafenib, stopping sorafenib for a few days around their procedure, and then continuing on sorafenib until progression.
Do you think that that is a strategy that's reasonable to do outside a protocol setting?
It's a tough question. There are a few different kinds of patients we see with embolization, and one of them is a group of patients who have tumors that can't be resected. They're too big to ablate, but they're very vascular. Some of those patients do remarkably well with embolization. I've actually treated patients with repeated embolizations for quite a number of years at times. That's not the majority of patients, but so a patient like that, I think it would be hard to imagine that they would benefit much from sorafenib given concomitantly. But there are patients who clearly don't respond well to embolization, and they end up on sorafenib relatively shortly thereafter. So you wonder if starting the sorafenib earlier around the time of embolization might benefit those folks. Additionally, there's data that when we do an embolization, the tumor will secrete a lot of VEGF in response to the hypoxia. So we wonder if perhaps that might assist the tumor's growth in the post-embolization period and maybe sort of inhibiting that VEGF signaling around the time of embolization might help. I feel like we need to see more randomized data, though, before we do that routinely.
What about the issue of embolization bland versus chemoembolization?
Yeah, another controversial one where I think the data set that exists is inadequate. My preference is to give chemoembolization. There have been meta-analyses of small trials that are suggestive that chemotherapy adds something. One of my colleagues at Duke and I have done an analysis, and we're in the process of writing this up for publication, of patients at our two institutions. And when we put patients who were chemoembolized into a multivariable model, chemotherapy does come out as an independent predictor of progression-free survival, although not overall survival. So it's a, you know, there's a mixed bag of literature out there on whether the chemotherapy is important.
So what happened with this man?
So he's actually now been on sorafenib for about 9 months. He's feeling well. No signs of progression to date. I'm scanning him about every 3 months, and so things are going well for now.
Did you say what happened in terms of the tumor after he got the chemoembolization?
Yeah, so right after embolization, in his particular case, he looked like a non-responder from an embolization standpoint, and I was very concerned that he wasn't going to do well, but then with subsequent scans, his tumor actually was showing signs of improvement. And, you know, I can't say for sure what component of that was sorafenib versus the embolization itself, but I suspect a lot of it was the sorafenib.
How long after the chemoembolization did you restart the sorafenib?
In that study, it was about a week for patients whose labs normalized after embolization.
What dose of sorafenib do you use, and in what situations do you alter the dose?
I would say the majority of my patients, I start sorafenib at 400 milligrams BID, so the labeled dose. I will make a decision every once in a while in a patient with higher bilirubins, more severe liver disease, you know, higher Bs like a B9, someone very sick, to try a 200 milligrams BID dosing at the start. I know some people who do that routinely. I've, you know, tended only to do that in patients I think look frail and then may dose escalate those folks if that's possible. It's interesting. Probably one of my best responders over the last few years was a guy I had to dose reduce, I think, three times when he started at standard dose. And was eventually on 200 milligrams every other day and actually had a rare, fantastic PR to therapy.
What kind of side effects were causing you to dose reduce that patient?
He was having some unusual ones. He was having a lot of nausea and abdominal discomfort, but he was having some more typical ones. He was having quite a bit of diarrhea, you know, was in and out of the clinic and the hospital very frequently because of dehydration, and having some hand-foot syndrome, although I think the GI issues were more of the problem in his case.
Any comments about the hand-foot syndrome with sorafenib? Any clinical pearls you throw out there to your fellows?
I think that one thing I do try to tell the fellows is before we dose reduce, especially with more mild to moderate hand-foot syndrome, is to give short breaks and try to restart at the same dose. I think you definitely see patients where the degree of hand-foot syndrome gets better over time. We also have a pretty good program of counseling patients internally. We have pharmacists who will come talk to them about, you know, using urea creams, making sure that they've taken care of any calluses, that they're wearing, you know, well-padded shoes. So those can avoid a lot of problems, you know, times when you can turn mild hand-foot syndrome into a big problem. So I think that's helpful. You know, I'll also credit Baron Onyx. They have some good programs to support patients with, you know, nursing over the phone. So patients have someone they can call and then who checks in on them about how they're doing and offers them tips as well. And I think that's helpful to us just to, you know, give the patients another avenue to get care.
Any new research strategies in HCC right now that look encouraging? Maybe this man might want to consider in the future.
You know, I'm hopeful that other VEGF-targeted agents will salvage patients after sorafenib failure. You know, there are a couple in trials like brivinib. Lenifenib is another drug that's being looked at right now. I mean, as an anecdote, and just as an example of how this might actually be possible, we were doing a trial with pazopanib, which I would say is not being extensively studied for HCC right now, but this was intended to be a liver dysfunction trial of pazopanib. And we had a patient who had clearly failed sorafenib, went on this pazopanib study and had a major response to pazopanib. So I'm hopeful that, like in renal cell cancer, we'll be able to see multiple VEGF inhibitors work. The other studies that are interesting to me out there, you know, erlotinib in combination with some of the VEGF agents, those trials are ongoing and are of interest. CLGB has an interesting study of adding doxorubicin to sorafenib, and that's based on some phase 2 data that Ghassan Abu Alfa published. And I think, you know, people have had limited enthusiasm about that because it's doxorubicin, it's not very sexy, and it is kind of toxic. But actually, the best comment I've heard about this was from Alan Vinook. He said, you know, if we had proposed doxorubinib and showed this data, then everybody would be excited about it. They're not so excited about doxorubicin. But I think that's a good and important study that needs to get done.
So how about this 55-year-old man with HCV?
So other patient here would be someone with Child Pugh B liver disease with a bilirubin of 2 with a 5-centimeter solitary tumor with no vascular invasion. So, you know, this person would be your ideal candidate for transplant if possible. Now, you know, the interesting thing about transplant is there's always a million reasons why someone cannot get transplanted. And in the case of many of our Hep C infected cirrhotics, it may have to do with prior substance abuse issues or social issues. So this person would be someone, because of the Child Pugh B liver status, would not be a resection candidate. And this would be the kind of person where I think that, you know, chemoembolization would be the most appropriate therapy. And as I said before, in most instances, if in someone who looks like a clear-cut good embolization candidate, I think giving sorafenib at the same time as embolization at this point is probably a little bit premature based on the data we have.
Now, this patient, was this somebody you actually took care of?
Yes, this is another, well, this represents many, many patients we see. I think this is a very common presentation of the sort of medium-sized lesion that's unresectable in someone who, you know, may or may not end up being a transplant candidate. And in this particular case, this is someone we had tried to keep on the transplant list and actually were able to embolize him successfully. He had some response. His tumor actually became a little bit smaller and necrotic. We followed it for a while. He was having issues with insurance and things that were preventing him from getting transplanted quickly. He had some tumor regrowth, and we were actually able to successfully re-embolize him. Unfortunately, he eventually fell off the transplant list, and so he has not really progressed dramatically. I think we can still manage him with embolization, but he's someone where we'll probably need to think about other options at some point because we may not be able to embolize him again.
What about this 58-year-old man? Can you talk about how he presented?
Sure. So this is an actual, and I think I have a picture here from the scan of this person. This is perhaps one of our, I would say, borderline areas where there's a lot of argument about what to do and really very little consensus on what the so-called right treatment is. But this is someone with Child-Pugh A liver disease but has a platelet count of 38,000. And what this scan shows is if you can see the portal vein there, you can see a pretty clear demarcation between where there's contrast in the portal vein and then none. So this is a portal vein thrombus, and you can see an area that's involved probably diffusely by tumor, and most of the dark areas you see there are thrombosed portal veins. So this is sort of a confined but diffuse HCC associated with a portal vein thrombus. And, you know, we have several strategies for this type of patient, but, you know, in all honesty, this is the kind of patient where we don't really know what the best treatment is at this point.
And did this patient have ascites?
This particular patient did not have much ascites. You know, in theory, someone like this could be resected even with that portal vein thrombus. With a thrombus like that, they're not able to be listed for transplant, but they can be resected. In this particular person's case, you can note from the scan that the spleen is fairly large and the platelet count's about 38,000. So this is someone, unfortunately, that we are unable to resect because of risk. And so we're sort of stuck with this localized but effectively incurable tumor.
In this kind of situation, do you see bleeds from the thrombocytopenia, and what do you do about it?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we will occasionally in these folks see variceal bleeds, but considering how many HCC patients I see, I would say that seeing these major bleeds has been relatively infrequent. I mean, the two types we can see, some patients will have bleeding from the tumor, so they'll have tumor rupture. That's a horrible problem, and thankfully, we don't see it all that often. And then the other big problem with the cirrhotics is the variceal bleeds. So we'll see those. For some reason, these patients who have cirrhosis and a low platelet count due to splenomegaly tend to tolerate that low platelet count fairly well.
So I'm curious what happened to this patient. I see that you were part of a paper in the Journal of Vascular Interventional Radiology on the use of yttrium 90 microspheres in patients with HCC and portal vein thrombosis. I don't know, is that what he got or not?
That is. That's what this particular patient got. One advantage of the yttrium spheres over chemoembolization is that it's much safer to administer in the setting of a portal vein thrombus. And the reason for that is that while these particles are theoretically embolic, the actual number of particles being delivered in a treatment is designed to deliver a particular radiation dose but does not fully embolize the region. So you can, you know, in the case of chemoembolization, if you have a portal vein out and you embolize the artery, you effectively have no blood flow to that segment of the liver, which can result in complications. So a patient like this can tolerate an yttrium 90 microsphere embolization very well.
That's fascinating. I never really thought about it. So what do you see when patients have had embolization with portal vein thrombosis? I don't know how many times that's been reported, but what exactly happens? They get necrosis?
Yeah, in bad cases, they'll get complete necrosis of an area, an abscess. They'll get hepatocyte damage in that region, and some patients just don't have enough liver reserve to tolerate that, so that will result in liver failure. It can be done. It's not an absolute contraindication, and you know, if you look at literature from Hopkins in particular, they've been able to push the envelope, and you know, it's been a moving target because of better and better, I guess, catheters, really. They're able to get to smaller and smaller portions of the liver, but still, in someone who has a major portal vein thrombus, most of us still consider that at least a relative contraindication to chemoembolization.
And how widely available are these yttrium microspheres?
Well, I think for most states, there are limited numbers of centers where it's done, although it has gotten pretty popular. So in the state of North Carolina, you've got the major academic centers doing it, but you also have several large community hospitals that are able to provide this. So it has fairly widespread availability, not quite as much as chemoembolization.
So what happened with this man?
So this particular person, we did choose the yttrium microspheres. You know, he has a tumor that's hard to measure. So again, he's someone we'd followed a few months afterwards with an MRI. He had stable disease for quite some time, but then eventually developed venous thrombosis and evidence of tumor involvement in the opposing lobe. at that point, you have a little bit of a dilemma. You know, do you keep chasing this with regional therapy or do you go to systemic therapy? And my preference in those cases really has been to go to sorafenib.
So what happened with him?
So he did get sorafenib and he's on sorafenib now. It's probably been about 6 months.
And what's happened to him and the tumor?
Well, the tumor, I think, in his case on sorafenib hasn't looked much different. He has a hard tumor to measure. So because of this diffuse nature of it, we don't expect to see much change. And those portal vein thrombi tend to remain static. You just don't see much change in them. So really, in his case, we're just looking for lack of progression as a sign of benefit.
And how is he tolerating treatment?
He's tolerated sorafenib quite well, actually. So this is someone who's had some minor hand-foot issues, but the kind where, you know, we can pause therapy without dose reduction.
Anything else you want to say about HCC that we haven't talked about?
Well, I guess one thing we didn't talk about for this particular type of patient, the reason I said that this is one of our more controversial patients is that this patient, if you look at the SHARP study, would have been a candidate for the SHARP trial.
That was looking at sorafenib.
Right. So in someone like him, the question right at the outset is it better to do regional therapy or is it better to start them on sorafenib? Or should we do both? And I think without the data, I'm hesitant to do both because now you're talking about a very expensive local regional therapy. The yttrium 90 therapies are relatively expensive. So without some proof of benefit of both. Now, what's interesting is I think the yttrium 90 spheres have gotten a lot of uptake in use without any randomized data. So, you know, if you think about this, we have a randomized study that's definitively shown an improvement in overall survival versus a regional therapy that's got, you know, large case series, but really no randomized data against any other form of therapy.
I've been thinking a lot about this recently, actually, you know, because you can kind of compare models across different tumors. And, you know, if you think about, let's say, metastatic breast cancer in terms of when you might want to use radiation therapy, say, to the bone, you know, you view this as a palliative situation. You generally try to go with systemic therapy and you use the local therapy when there's a local problem or an imminent threat of a problem. Do you think that model applies here or not really because you're also trying to sort of debulk?
Yeah, it's very hard to say. I think there has, in the pre-sorafenib era, there was this bias that the liver problem was the biggest problem because A, it was often the most symptomatic problem, and B, patients were likely to die of liver failure but not likely to die because they had little lung metastases or other. Now that we have, you know, a drug that potentially can control both sites, you know, do we still do embolization? And cases where I think it's easily justifiable to do a regional therapy are those where the patient has a very symptomatic liver tumor but also has some extrahepatic disease. And those patients, I think, absolutely make sense to go ahead and do the regional therapy because that can be palliative for symptoms, but the patient still needs some systemic therapy because of their mets. And we see a fair amount of that.
And that really fits right into this metastatic breast cancer model. Obviously, there's a lot more choices available with metastatic breast cancer. But again, I think about a patient with a large primary breast cancer that's not causing any problems, not ulcerating. A lot of docs will try hormone therapy or chemo or trastuzumab if they're HER2 positive, try to shrink it down. And I don't know if that kind of thinking sort of applies to HCC or not.
Yeah, no, I think that is very similar. Many people have sort of tossed around those ideas of, you know, does it really make sense to do regional therapy in someone who has metastatic disease? If we had much better systemic therapies, most often the answer would be no. I think in colon cancer, we don't do anything to the primary tumor because we know that the drugs are going to help the mets and the primary tumor. But with sorafenib, since we know we can control the disease but don't really often affect the size of the tumor by very much, if someone's symptomatic, I think you have a much better chance of getting local control with something like embolization.
Final question, what's your perception both in academic centers and in the community about the issue of, I'll call it TURF in HCC, sort of the, I don't know, the vascular radiologist on one end and the medical oncologist on the other end and the surgeons in between?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very interesting disease from that standpoint where you have a lot of people taking ownership of the patients and various routes by which patients can get into the system. At your transplant centers like our own and, you know, the other big centers, I think the patient flow tends to be controlled by hepatologists because they're often following the patient, you know, from having chronic hepatitis, doing the screening, making the diagnosis, and sort of our head of our hepatology group likes to liken himself to the quarterback of the team, which is fine, I guess. I think he called me the punter.
Punter. Hmm. All right. How about the reserve defensive end? Well, you know, it was interesting. I guess Alan Minook presented the, I think it was called the Gideon sort of registry study.
Right,
and
right.
That was the first time I saw he reported differences. I didn't even realize that hepatologists use sorafenib. And according to him, they use it a lot and not necessarily the same way oncologists do.
Absolutely. And I've also heard that one of the biggest users of sorafenib in the state of North Carolina is a hepatologist. And, you know, at our center, the hepatologists prefer not to, but at other places, I think if they're comfortable, you know, frankly, these guys are giving interferon, which is not a picnic. And I think they can manage sorafenib if they're comfortable. But there were interesting differences in how they were dosing and dose reducing compared to oncologists that seemed to reflect that the oncologists were a little more conservative about how they did things. But, you know, who's right? I don't know.
Right. And I guess also there's the issue of the management of the underlying liver disease. I don't know how often that actually is more of a health threat than the HCC, but it seems like it's not rare.
No. And frankly, in the folks with child Pew B, especially 8s and 9s liver disease, they're just as likely to die from progressive liver disease as from the cancer and in a relatively short period of time. So I personally don't think it's inappropriate at all for hepatologists to manage these patients on sorafenib. You know, as an academic institution, my preference is that we make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of doing studies where it's appropriate. We obviously don't have good enough therapy for these folks, and so we need to get them on trials as much as possible. And, you know, at our institution, thankfully, we've had a lot of cooperation between the medical oncology and the hepatology in terms of, you know, making sure that patients are able to get on studies where it's appropriate and aren't just, you know, put on sorafenib by someone who's not aware of what kinds of trials are going on.
Let's close out this chat with your thoughts on other recent data sets in GI cancer that have the potential to significantly impact practice.
I think there were several big rectal cancer studies that reported, and I think that the one sort of take-home message for me is that, you know, we can feel comfortable using capecitabine for rectal cancer during radiation instead of continuous infusion 5-FU. And I had been pretty conservative. I'd been waiting for those data, and it looks like it's just as good.
So I guess there were two studies, a German study, and then finally the NSABP-R04 study that we've heard about for so long.
Right.
You know, it's always been kind of strange to me in a way, you know, why people use 5-FU. I mean, you say you've used it. Do you think that really up until now we really haven't had the data to be able to comfortably consider capecitabine?
You know, I think a lot of people have been comfortable using capecitabine. Because we're dealing with a curable population, I tend to run on the conservative side. I'd rather make sure we're not losing anything in terms of especially overall survival for that population. I think I'm willing to stretch things a little more toward, you know, we're talking about convenience here, really. And for patients with metastatic disease, when we're talking about balancing quantity of life and quality of life, I think capecitabine often makes a lot of sense. But, you know, I was cautious about it in this curative disease setting. And I think these data made me a lot more comfortable.
I guess the other part of the NSABP trial that came out is the issue about oxaliplatin and neoadjuvant therapy, which we have seen data in the past before, but again, we saw pretty unimpressive.
Yeah, you know, surprising in a way, although maybe not too surprising. I think we've gotten to a point in our care of rectal cancer patients, maybe mostly or partly due to improvements in surgical technique, where our local recurrence rates are so low that it's going to be hard to demonstrate improvements from radiosensitizing therapy. And one question that was interesting about adding oxaliplatin early was, does it matter if you get the oxaliplatin in now versus waiting until after radiation? Are you perhaps delaying the systemic therapy aspect of that? And seems as though the answer is no, it doesn't matter that much.
Any other recent data sets in GI oncology that caught your eye?
I think one that was of some interest, although I think we're going to need to better define the population, is the presentation by Kathy Yang, which, you know, there was also a presentation at ASCO GI of the same data, but with the c-MET inhibitor in combination with, in this case, panitumumab. There seemed to be a signal there, and this is a disease where we really desperately need more drugs. And I think this gives us hope that I don't think this is going to be a home run in unselected colon cancer patients, but I think this really gives us hope that we can find a population of patients that's going to benefit from another agent.
Now, this was with chemo or not?
It was with panitumumab, no chemotherapy in that.
And did they see objective responses?
There were objective responses, a little bit higher than what you would expect for panitumumab alone. And the nice thing about that study is there was a comparator arm with panitumumab plus an insulin-like growth factor receptor inhibitor. And you saw a better progression-free survival and overall survival with the mTOR inhibitor. So, you know, if one assumes perhaps in this case that the IGF-1R antibody was not very active, it suggests that you really saw some improvements in hard endpoints.
Yeah, the IGF-R type approach seems to have been kind of a bust that looked kind of like good. And so far, I don't know, is anything positive coming out?
On the GI cancer front, it's been slow. I'm still holding out hope, sort of like other drugs where we just really need to work on defining the right tumor. I'm still betting that there are insulin-like growth factor pathway-dependent tumors out there. We just need to find them. And if we're looking at all comers, it's going to be hard to see it.